Once again, welcome to Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Papp joined by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, one family's discovery of a lifetime, on the beach no less. One mammal's return to a region where they were previously extinct. A milk-producing amphibian is found. And this week in history, Coke is finally bottled up. That's coming up. It's Cool Stuff. In the UK, one family got quite the surprise while taking a stroll on the beach. That surprise came in the form of 8 massive fossilized dinosaur footprints. Vicky Ballinger and her 2 kids were out for an evening walk in Bexhill-on-Sea shortly after several rounds of heavy rain and high tide had worn away the sand, exposing the rock beneath. Vicky told the local newspaper, The Argus, quote, "I grew up in Bexhill and I've never seen these ones before. I believe they're iguanodon footprints. They aren't T-Rex tracks, as they were not about in England," end quote. More on the iguanodon in a moment, but if you're wondering why Vicky phrased things the way she did, meaning never seen these ones before, it's because Bexhill-on-Sea is already well known for its dinosaur fossils. In fact, dino enthusiasts are often known to be scouring the coastline in search of dinosaur remains or the next big find. Just this past January, retired biology teacher Sue Lee was able to relocate 4 iguanodon footprints that she initially discovered almost 25 years ago. And in 2018, a man found the world's first known fossilized dinosaur brain on Bexhill Beach. It was a 133-million-year-old sample of mineralized tissue from inside a dinosaur's skull. How crazy is that? That same year, more than 85 footprints from the Cretaceous period, made up of at least 7 different species, were uncovered by the cliffs between Hastings and Fairlight, including the fine details of skin and scales, that last bit per GNN. The rocks Bexhill is situated on are around 140 million years old and contain the remains of the dinosaurs that used to roam when freshwater surroundings were what made up that area. A statement on Bexhill Museum's website reads, quote, "The landscape where the prints were found would have been dominated by dinosaurs, and most of the fossil remains that can be identified belonged to Iguanodon, a 5 to 10 meter long plant-eating dinosaur," end quote. That's around 16 to 30 feet, if you're wondering. So if you do a quick search, you'll realize there are a number of different depictions of the Iguanodon out there. It was believed to live in the early Cretaceous period, approximately 140 to 110 million years ago. As the Bexhill Museum noted, it was an herbivore, despite looking a bit menacing in artist depictions. Not sure I'd feel all that great running into one of these guys, even if I knew they didn't eat meat. Per the Natural History Museum in London, Iguanodon could probably walk on all fours or go bipedal on 2 legs. It had a large thumb spike on the end of its hand, likely to fend off predators, and the structure of the muscles inside its head suggests it had a very long tongue. So there you go. Now you know all about the Iguanodon, including its Gene Simmons-like tongue. Over the years, the fossils of several dinosaur species have been found in Bexhill, including Iguanodon, Megalosaurus, Baryonyx, Polacanthus, and the tooth of a Velociraptor-type animal, many of which are on display now at Bexhill Museum. So if you happen to find yourself in the area, Reg, on a UK trek, might be something cool to go check out, because I have to say, I think I'd be pretty mesmerized if I saw some real-life dinosaur footprints.
I would be too, and I'm amused by Vicky pointing out that it must be the fact that she lives around that area, so maybe they're more familiar with this, that she pointed out, like, oh, they're probably iguanodon footprints. There weren't T-Rexes around here at this time. You know, it just, it's so matter of fact the way she said it, that, like, every mom knows this, right?
You're right. It has to be just, hey, look, we live in an area where this is pretty common, and therefore they have that knowledge in their head. But I took a look, and obviously we'll have the link in the show notes today, but if you go check this out, they're massive prints. And thinking, just sitting there imagining running into something that produced that size of a footprint is a little bit scary, I'm not gonna lie.
Especially with those thumbs. It sounds like the little pokey thumbs that they have.
No thumb wars with the iguanodon. Well, from one group of extinct animals to one who was thought to be long gone, at least in a particular region of the world, the New England Aquarium Aerial Survey Team recently spotted a gray whale off the New England coast. Now, maybe you're asking yourself, what's the big deal? Well, while gray whales are relatively abundant in the North Pacific Ocean, they've been extinct in the Atlantic Ocean for more than 200 years, disappearing in the 18th century. As part of their reporting on the event, the Washington Post pulled up a colonial official's writing from 1729 that described a, quote, scrag whale off the coast of Massachusetts, believed to be the last time a gray whale was sighted in that area. Research technician Kate Lamley was in the aerial survey plane roughly 30 miles south of Nantucket when they spotted the whale back on March 1st. They wound up circling the area for 45 minutes, allowing observers to capture additional photos. Lamley later said via press release, quote, "My brain was trying to process what I was seeing because this animal is something that should not really exist in these waters. We were laughing because of how wild and exciting this was to see an animal that disappeared from the Atlantic hundreds of years ago," end quote. Aquarian scientists believe the gray whale seen off New England this month is the same whale spotted in Florida late last year. So, what gives here? Per GNN, scientists are pointing to climate change to explain the occurrence. The Northwest Passage, which connects the Atlantic and Pacific through the Arctic Ocean in Canada, has regularly been ice-free in the summertime in recent years, partly due to rising global temperatures. Historically, the sea ice has contained the whales to the Pacific as they're unable to break through the thick winter ice that usually blocks said passage. Now gray whales can potentially travel that passage in the summer, something that wouldn't have been possible in the previous century. Said Orla O'Brien of the New England Aquarium, quote, "This sighting highlights how important each survey is. While we expect to see humpback, right, and fin whales, the ocean is a dynamic ecosystem, and you never know what you'll find. These sightings of gray whales in the Atlantic serve as a reminder of how quickly marine species respond to climate change, given the chance," end quote. That said, the Washington Post also spoke with Lee Torres, a marine biologist from Oregon State University. She felt the most likely explanation was that whale that they spotted was a juvenile who simply took a wrong turn, as she put it. She said, quote, "I consider gray whales to be risk takers, meaning they show up and feed in places that we often don't expect or consider normal. Such behavior sometimes provides good adaptation to changing conditions, like finding a new feeding area or food type," end quote. Gray whales can be distinguished from other species by their lack of a dorsal fin, mottled gray and white skin, and dorsal hump followed by pronounced ridges.
So this one's there all by itself, no other gray whales?
Well, that's the understanding as of now. I mean, it's certainly possible there are others beneath the surface, but is in terms of what's been spotted, yeah, just the one thus far.
It's got to be kind of lonely. I mean, it sounds like maybe it did take a wrong turn, and you think it's going to want some company at some point.
Well, if they think it's the same whale that was in Florida, it's certainly done its fair share of swimming over the last few months. And you're right, is it trying to get back to the Pacific? Who really knows? But surviving out there, at the very least.
Maybe it just needed a vacation, wanted to visit Florida. Now it's heading to England.
I've heard great things about the tropics. Let me get out of Northern California for a few months.
That's right. Sticking with an animal theme here, but going a lot smaller, a milk-producing amphibian has been found. The worm-like amphibians, known as Caecilians, have no legs, their eyes are basically useless, and their bodies are long and segmented like an earthworm after years of evolution due to their ancestors burrowing deep underground about 150 million years ago. But don't confuse them with a worm. Marta Antoniazzi, a Brazilian biologist who is part of the research team, thinks they are wonderful, quote, "They are kind of elegant, they have a shiny body, and a very nice face," end quote. Not really how I would describe them. I don't really know how you judge the face on them, but okay. With Caecilians, once a week, the babies eat their mother's skin off for sustenance.
Good God.
However, that doesn't harm the mom, and it's good for the babies as it's full of nutrients. As the team was studying this particular Caecilian, which is found in Brazil and called Siphonops annulatus, they analyzed more than 200 hours of video that they took of the mom and its newborn babies. When they were doing that, they noticed the babies focused on one spot of the mother, the tail. After closer inspection, they saw a milk-like substance being secreted. As they tested the so-called milk, they discovered that it contained lipids and sugars, which is very similar to milk produced by mammals. But that isn't normal for an egg-laying animal to provide milk for their young. This is a case of convergent evolution, where different species can develop similar traits, in this case how an amphibian produces milk like a mammal, even though they don't have an ancestral connection. Antoniazzi said that it is a good reminder that while animals can be very different, they can still have a lot in common. Quote, "Nature is very creative. Sometimes it gives the same solution to different groups of animals," end quote. Now, Is it milk, though? While it hasn't been tested on any drinkable standards, those lipids and sugars I mentioned technically make it functionally similar to milk produced by all mammals. However, don't expect any farms to be popping up to harvest it. It definitely isn't FDA approved.
Yuck. I'm looking at the picture of this thing right now, and the last thing I want to think about is eating something that it secreted.
Are you going to describe it as elegant, shiny body with a very nice face? I just don't see that.
No,
I
am not. That's like something only a mother would say, except clearly this lady's not the mother of one of these things. So I guess a researcher or someone who's familiar, you probably fall in love with your work.
That's very passionate about it. Yeah.
Yeah, clearly. Because no, that's not going to be the description you hear from most people. I'm going to go out on a limb with that one.
University of California Berkeley biologist Marvalee Wake, who was not part of this study, said the fact that Sicilians are, quote, both a skin feeder and now a milk producer is pretty amazing. Most species have not been studied at this level of detail, end quote. So who knows what we'll find if we, you know, study more species to a little bit more detail. We might find more amphibians that are milk, or, you know, something else crazy that's out there, or other traits that they might have that we may not know.
Yeah, certainly possible. I mean, the combination of the look of this thing with the skin eating and the nasty look at milk production. Not high on my list of cuddly creatures or potential pet prospects, so put it that way.
You know, actually looking at this thing, if I didn't know it was an amphibian, it'd be a good chance I picked it up out of the ground and put it on a hook and threw it out in the water.
Yeah,
it does look like an earthworm.
You're not wrong about that, because there are a lot of cute amphibians, you know,
they're cute.
Yeah, this guy, you know, he's a distant relative, or he didn't come from the same gene pool there. That was obviously it's a joke, but not the prettiest looking thing in the world.
Taking a look at this day in history, we'll actually talk about something that you might want to drink, not that amphibian milk.
More appetizing, yes.
Yes. On March 12th, 1894, the first bottle of Coke was sold. Now, Coke was actually created in 1886 by John Pemberton as a non-addictive substitute for morphine, which always still makes me laugh. But you don't want to be addicted to that morphine? Drink some Coke. Later, it was sold as a non-alcoholic temperance drink. As history has shown, the original Coke was made from extract of the cocoa leaf. So that's where it got its name Coke, because they did use cocaine, I guess, in some way, which I guess makes it the substitute for morphine, which, again, it amuses me of way back then what we thought was safe. You know, have your daily morphine, have some cocaine. It's okay. The fact that John Pemberton was a pharmacist and he's, you know, doling this substance out, it is kind of interesting, just the mentality of the stuff we learn over time. Going back to the Coke topic, Asa Griggs Candler ended up with the rights for Coke, and his nephew told him he should bottle it. It would sell better. However, Candler didn't agree and only wanted to continue selling it as a fountain drink. So it was a candy shop owner from Vicksburg, Mississippi named Joseph A. Biedenharn who was the first to bottle the popular drink. Since he was doing it on his own, he used Hutchinson bottles, which were pretty common reusable bottles for that time. It definitely didn't look like the Coke bottle that you're used to now. Biedenharn did send Candler a sample of Coke in a bottle, but Candler still said no, it should only be a fountain drink. Which he later ended up selling the bottling rights, Candler did, 5 years later. But since he was still convinced that it was worthless, he sold it for $1, which he never collected. The good news for that candy shop owner, that contract that had the national bottling rights, did not include Vicksburg, so he was still able to sell his own bottles in his hometown. By 1915, the brothers who owned the bottling rights for Coke were looking for a new design. It was Roots Glass Company out of Indiana that came up with that classic Coke bottle design. And as a side note, the contract for bottling Coke said that the bottle should only cost 5 cents, and it had no end date on that. So that is why Coke cost 5 cents a bottle until 1959, when they finally made a change with that.
Yeah, I wish they would have kept that pricing in place.
Wow. Yeah, I think Coke probably would have gone out of business if they still kept that model.
Well, or they couldn't keep up with demand. No, you're right. Yeah, I got to believe that it costs a little more to produce than 5 cents these days. So that's pretty wild, though, to think about, hey, you gave up the bottling rights to probably the most popular beverage, at least in the U.S., outside of, I don't know, water.
Why wouldn't you even, he didn't believe it would be successful at all. Everyone kept telling him, you should do this. He's like, nah, I don't like it.
Well, and it's tough to place yourself in this guy's shoes at this point in history, but to your point, what's the harm? If you allow someone to do it, see how sales are and go from there. This just reeks of stubbornness saying, nope, I don't want to do it. I like it as a fountain drink and that's it. And why you're so stubborn about it, God only knows. But
candy shop owner was having success with it. He was bottling it on his own and having success. Why wouldn't that be a great example of you should be doing this?
Now, to be clear, fountain Coke, always better than bottled Coke. Okay. Not even a debate. Not even a debate.
Maybe he was the first one that had that true, strong belief. And like, nope, you can't have it as a bottle. It's better as a fountain. I mean, the bottle did originally, when you had the candy shop owner doing it, he did put it basically from a fountain drink into a bottle and just closed it up.
So it was bottled fountain soda. Sure. Yeah.
It was exactly what it was. So, I mean, back then, I kind of wonder the transportation process, how it would taste. Because right now you get it sealed tight. You can keep that carbonation just the way it is.
Yep.
I don't know how it would taste as you like bring it home and like put it in your fridge and drink it a couple days later.
Yeah, you wonder, is it something that you're purchasing at the point in time that you want it? Like, hey, Joey, go take these bottled Cokes. I just bottled them all up. Take them out about town and start selling them to people. It's lunchtime. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure what the approach would have been, but that is fascinating to think about.
That'll do it for another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. You can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Feel free to leave comments or corrections if we have any. I know we probably don't get anything wrong, Marcus, so what corrections should there be?
Never. That's why you don't solicit complaints anymore.
That's right. There's no complaints out there. Nobody says anything bad. Also, please like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.